Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Tuesday, January 17th. We took one day off. It was Martin Luther King Day here in the United States yesterday. Can't be working on MLK Day. Plus, we wanted to give a little bit of extra time for, women's tournament to wrap up and the men's one to sort of fully kick off, because we've got lots of TDU to talk about. And joining us on the show today to talk TDU all the way from Adelaide, Rupert Guinness. Welcome back to the pod, Rupe.
Hey, Kaylee. Great to be here. I'm actually in the town of Tanunda, the start and finish of stage one of the men's tour, and in the Barossa Valley, but it's too early to sample any Barossa wines right now, but in a few hours, certainly I'll have a glass in my hand, I'm sure.
Looks a bit breezy and pretty warm.
Yeah, look, funnily enough, we're in the middle of, meant to be the peak of the Aussie summer and the Aussie summer of cycling, but as we saw last night, the heavens opened for the prologue in Adelaide, in downtown Adelaide, the first ever prologue or time trial we've had in this race, and it's cloudy and windy, and it was raining this morning, although the rain is holding off. So it's not as hot as we've known Tanunda to be, but, later in the week, the hot conditions are expected to return.
Not, 43 or 44, I think, last Tour Down Under that I was at. Somewhat a bit of a shock to the system for me coming from northern winter, where we have about 2 feet of snow on the ground here today. Also on the show today, welcome back, Dave Rome.
Hello. How are you? I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Dane Cash, welcome back.
Hi, Kaylee. Hi, Rupert. Hi, Dave. How are we doing?
Good. Yeah. Well, we've got, like I said, we've got a fair amount to talk about. We've got TDU to run through. We are actually going to be hearing from Abby Mickey later to talk about the Women's Tour Down Under that just wrapped up. Abby, of course, a women's cycling expert, former member of the Women's Professional Peloton. So we got her insight into women's TDU. We'll hear from her in a bit. We've got Cav news. The running joke here on this podcast that we talk about Cav every single week. Maybe we can stop next week, but this week we cannot. It was confirmed, in fact, this morning, U.S. time, that Mark Cavendish will indeed join Astana.
That's it for us, right? Pod's over now, because that's been the only thing that we've really, that's been our constant.
I would like to just go on pretending that we don't know where he is and just keep every week speculating
that's
where
good.
He might be going.
He's apparently been, he's been talking up the excellent organization behind Astana to friends and other riders, and he seems to be quite happy there. The announcement was made via social media, as I said, Tuesday morning, sort of North American time. And to be honest, his national champ kit looks superb. One thing about Astana, love or hate Astana, and I would say that probably more of our listeners are on the latter side of that, they always do a good kit. And they have indeed done a good kit for Mark Cavendish, and that was the means by which they announced it today. This is, of course, about 36 hours after a photo was leaked of him appearing to get into an Astana team car at an airport in Spain. I had this photo sent to me by a number of people to the point where I had no real clue where the original photo came from. Posted it on Twitter, and it went gangbusters as sort of the first proof, real proof, visual proof that that Cav was officially going to join Astana. And then, a day or so later, 2 days later, we've got the official word. So now that that's happened, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but now that that's happened, are we cool with Cav to Astana? Does that feel like a decent fit? Is it?
I mean, they didn't ask my permission, but
they didn't
allow it.
Oh, so. I thought that was the standard thing. They would just call.
Very rude. Very, very rude. But, yeah, I'm just happy to see him get a ride that will allow him to start in the tour.
Yeah, I wouldn't put them on the top of the list of teams I would have wanted him to go to, but as long, like you said, as long as he's going to the Tour de France and is able to kind of contest that record, whether he makes it or not, I mean, whether he wins a stage or not at the Tour de France, I think it's good for the sport. The storyline is great, and we see when we write about him, people want to read about it, or when we talk about him on a podcast, I hope they want to hear about it because we've been doing it a lot.
I think also it's going to, this field of sprinters, it's going to be great at the Tour anyway, but to have Cav in that very rich and deep, you know, field of sprinters is going to, you know, really make it look like a, you know, a world championship sprint for several days. You know, they're going to be some fantastic sprints there, and it'd be a shame if Cav wasn't amongst those sprints. And certainly, if he's going to jag that historic stage win, he's going to have to earn it. It's not going to be an easy one to get, but that's the way history should be reached out for, and I hope made. I really hope he gets that stage win, that historic stage win.
When we were first kind of talking about where Cav might end up in the beginnings of all of this, back when we were just starting the placeholders, and by the way, when we and everybody else on the planet, because we're not really going to take credit for being saying something that everybody else is saying, we pointed out that Astana did have an open spot, but duh. Anyway, we did mention that there are a lot of smaller teams or teams that had smaller bike brand sponsors that might really benefit from having somebody of his caliber, of his level of popularity, riding on that on their bike to win a Tour de France stage. And
unless he ends up chucking it across the
road. Well, if it doesn't go well, it doesn't go well. Like so there's it's a gamble. But I think, you know, a brand like Villiers, which not on the same sales level, I guess you could say, as some other really big names, but a bike, I think they look great. I think they're great looking bikes. I know, Kayla, you've ridden a few years ago. You were on the Villiers a fair bit. So I think it's really cool, and I think that brand could really benefit from doing this. And according to Gazzetta, the brand Brass, I guess you could say, kind of, I think, shelled out a little bit of cash or was involved, I guess, in making this deal happen. And I think that's a smart play.
They are beautiful bikes. I would say, again, like good kits and good bikes, and from a visual perspective, and they have been for quite some time. So if nothing else, even if this is a bit of Cav washing, and a team that we have mostly spoken, I would say, negatively about over the last couple of years, is going to get some positive headlines because of their association with this particular rider. Even if we ignore all of that, it's going to look good. So that makes me somewhat happy. Let's leave Cav for now. Maybe for a while, actually. I think we'll keep an eye on how his lead-out train's coming together and all that sort of stuff, but we can stop that particular storyline. And I want to get into TDU, which is the whole reason why we have Rupert on this podcast. Rupe, you also got there in a somewhat unusual way. How did you find yourself traveling all the way down to Adelaide?
Yeah, I guess desperate times call for desperate measures, and I didn't fly down as I usually do. I didn't need to Adelaide. I came down on my bike, but I didn't ride from Sydney, but I was actually in the town of Bright in the Victorian Alps, south of Sydney, for 4 days on a bit of a not training camp, just riding in the mountains. And then before I planned that trip, I had a call from former pro Mitch Docker, who asked me to would I be keen on doing a pilgrimage ride to the Two Down Under. I immediately said, yeah, why not, no problem, great. Hung up the phone and then thought I better think about who else he's talking about. And the others were Lachlan Mortlock, the Australian cyclocross champion Tommy Chapman, two female professionals, Peter Mullins, who's a multi-Australian champion in various disciplines, Ella Bloor, and I guess myself. Certainly the anchor in age and cycling credentials. And we had to leave from Ballarat, which is where the national championships were held. And so I was in Bright, and the simplest and cheapest way for me to get to Ballarat, instead of driving back to Sydney, packing my bike and flying all the way down to Melbourne, getting out to Ballarat, was to ride the 450 kilometres to Ballarat. So I'd done four days of riding in the mountains in Bright, and then 2.5 days to get to Ballarat. And then the next day after the national championships, we set off, me and five professionals, for another 1,100 to 1,200 kilometres to Adelaide, of which a third was on gravel. And like I said, I was definitely the anchor, and my time at the front, doing turns at the front, was very minimal. Usually it was when we approached a petrol station or a pub at the end of a ride, I'd lead my charge then. And a third was on the gravel, and it wasn't even just gravel. Some sections were like sand, you know. It's just like, you know, there's like 40 or 50 kilometre stretches of gravel. But there was like one day on the second last day where it was like, for the first few kilometers, like we were all off our bikes pushing through this sand, and this hot red sand's going into your shoes, and you don't know whether this is going to be for 40 kilometers or just one more kilometer. And there was a point there I actually did think, oh my gosh, we're going to be here for days, you know, like the old overlanders in the 1890s. And anyway, so no, it was a fabulous experience. And so it ended up being for me like 2,200 kilometers in 12 days.
Wow.
But it was a great experience. No, and it was great on, in all seriousness, the diversity in age and experience and personalities in that group of six was far-reaching on so many levels. But there wasn't one dummy spit the whole week, the whole 5 days, you know, which was quite remarkable. So it's a credit to Mitch Docker for his assembly, and he's now sort of getting the right personalities to have the right people there. And we're all at different levels of recovery this week. I'm definitely on the coffee ride run this week.
Maybe we'll work on the travel budget for the placeholders for next year, so you can just fly back down. We'll endeavor to fix that one for you for next year. That sounds like a pretty incredible ride, though.
Yeah. I'm definitely flying back too. But it was a great week of preparation for, you know, for my RAM in June, my Race Across America bid number two. And there was a lot, you know, the heat, you know, it was like over 40 degrees most days, and as well as the 1/3 of the distance being on gravel. So I was in great company for a tough week.
Sounds fantastic. Mm. What's it like there now that you've arrived? You've made it down to TDU Central, even though you're not in Adelaide right now. The race has been, well, quite a bit smaller for a couple of years. Obviously, we're coming out of COVID. This is the first year back as a World Tour event. What's the vibe like down there? Is it like it was before? Bigger, smaller? What's it feeling like?
I would say it's actually bigger. I think if you throw back to the last two down under, it was the area of South Australia had been and the countryside outside of Adelaide had been ravaged by bushfires, and I remember the race there was you know, going through the ground zero areas of devastation and tragedy, and you could smell the smoke of houses and forests that had been burnt down. And coming back to where we are now, there really is a sense of pure joy that this race, a bicycle race that helped them get through some tragic times a couple of years ago, is back again, and now we can celebrate what's great about cycling and the community spirit. And it's been, as I'm talking now, the stage one, I'm in Tanunda, it's just about to fly past me, so you may hear a bit of noise in one of the circuits here. But it's a great celebration, I think. Obviously, it's only stage one of the men's event, but the women's tour, you know, really set up a fabulous week. It was a great race, and it was fantastic with that being a World Tour event. And then it leads into what we have started now, this men's tour. And some changes at Stuart O'Grady, the new race director. It's his first tour down under as race director. There's a lot of elements to that alone, which will be very interesting to see how that unfolds over this week. And he has brought in several changes, such as last night's historic time trial or prologue.
Yeah, let's get right into that. I mean, I do want to talk a little bit about that, the sort of the racing that's happened so far, but let's get into the changes. I mean Stewie brought in, as you said, he brought in the prologue. Wollonga is gone. You said you ran into Richie Port, the king of Wollonga Hill, who you know, Richie's gone, so I guess the hill has to go as well. How have those changes been received? Like, what's the feeling on the ground there?
Well, firstly with Richie, yes, we might as well talk about the king of Wollonga. I guess he's abdicated the throne, but the throne's not there this year, so I guess he's still
he's
the king
forever.
Of Wollonga. He's got it forever. Yeah. You know how they retire numbers. Maybe I should retire Wollonga Hill. You know, but I think Richie. I was in contact with Richie this morning, and he did say, gee, it's great to be on this side of the fence and to be at a bike race, to enjoy a bike race without having the pressure of, one, having to race it, two, having to win it. He's got out amongst some people, and he is really enjoying it. I know for a fact he was really ready for his retirement, and I think now he's back in Australia. It was great for him to be able to come back to a race which he left such a major impact on, and in which he was very proud for the achievements that he did. So I think that's a nice sort of segue of transition for him and the race. Other changes, and we spoke about the time trial prologue last night in downtown Adelaide. it was unfortunate that the heavens opened up as they did. But that's Mother Nature. You can't control that. It was a very brave call by Stuart O'Grady, the race director, to bring in a time trial. It's been a point of discussion ever since this race started. And Mike Turner, the previous race director, who has led this race, you know, as a director fabulously for the years he did, but he was always reluctant to create a time trial. Full kudos to Stuart for saying, I'm going to bring changes in. And he followed those calls by actually doing it. And the prologue last night, okay, we all know when it rains, it rains, you know, and whoever goes off early before it rains gets the game. You know, the winner, Alberto Bettiol, he did ask his team to be the first rider of his team to go, because he wanted to be able to fine tune or to get to know the cornering so he can on pass that knowledge to the other riders. But in the end, he was the big beneficiary of it, and he jagged the ochre yellow leader's jersey, which he's wearing right now. A couple of other changes. Obviously, we spoke about Wollunga Hill not being in there. Wollunga, the town, will be there, but the crescendo of this race, you know, it will be on Sunday. We will finish up Mount Lofty, so we still will have a hilltop finish, which inevitably will probably determine the overall result. But you know, Mount Lofty is a lot of people have climbed up it, so fans will know what that hill is like, and they'll know the vantage points to get out to. So you'll be seeing some fabulous pictures up there, and I think a great finish to the race.
Dane, where do we stand from a racing perspective right now? As Roop said, stage is about to kick off. Alberto Bettiol is in the ochre jersey as the winner of the prologue. What else happened in that?
Well, there's
prologue?
A major caveat here, Kaylee, and that is it. For our listeners, it really depends on how quickly you edit this podcast, because by the time you finish, we could have seen another stage, and I will not have that information. But I'm going to talk just about the prologue and where things are. And to the listeners, you know, if a lot's happened, you're going to have to blame Gail. You're going to have to tweet at him, send him an email. Just blow him up. You need to really tell him that he needs to get on it quicker.
Dane, I'd like you to give a stage one race report, and then we'll actually be able to compare.
I'll do my best. Stage one is a tricky one to do a pre-stage report for, because there's all those climbs of that hill. If it were a sprint, it'd be okay, fine. But all right, the prologue, though, that did already happen, that I don't have to make up. Yeah, Roop said it. Alberto Bettiol was the winner, and that's a pretty unexpected turn of events. In that Bettiol, he's got a big engine. Obviously, you don't win the Tour of Flanders attacking with like 15-20k to go if you don't have a big engine. But he's not really known as being some guy who's great at time trials. But a short time trial, and when it's dry, well, that works in your favor. And maybe Rome can talk a little bit more about this, but the tech side of this was also really interesting, the way that basically anybody who competed or was competitive, sorry, for the victory in this prologue was typically doing so with some, you know, mini tweaks, I guess, to the typical road setup. If you're watching, you're seeing shifters, you know, bent way inward to make them more aero. Just any number of other like little minor tweaks that were allowed because there were no TT bikes. So they're on road bikes, but they're attempting to make them as aero as possible. So Alberto Bettiol did a nice job of kind of working with what he had, you know, riding with his, well, obviously the people I'm talking to can see me, but if you're at home, you can't see. I'm trying to mimic the way that his hands were farther in than they normally would be. And he was a very early starter. That said, some of the later starters also got to race on drier roads and were unable to knock him out of the hot seat. So it wasn't, I don't think we can say just the weather. I think Bettiol did a great job riding his race. And Magnus Sheffield finished second, probably because he spoke to the placeholders a few weeks ago. We are now 100% of riders who have spoken to the placeholders have finished in podium positions in 100% of their races so far, assuming Kaylee finishes the edit before stage one finishes.
Let's talk about the tech really quick. We got lots of tech to talk about in our geek warning later, but while we're on this topic, while we're on the prologue topic, Dave, what exactly were they doing here? So they banned time trial bikes, first and foremost, because they didn't want to have to bring TT bikes down. We talked about that, I think, in
the
previous
episode.
They banned
time trial bikes. They banned the use of aero handlebars, aero extensions that some riders would have been able to attach to the center of their road bikes. Riders were forced to get pretty creative at that point and, I guess, push to the extremes of road setups that we're starting to see, where the hoods are now more canted inward. and in some cases a bit more higher, which allows them to stay in the hoods rather than feel like they need to get into the drops. And being in the hoods allows them to sort of, drop the elbows a bit, keep the forearm sort of horizontal to the ground, and be just narrower in profile, in the frontal profile.
Yeah, I think the most extreme version that we saw, you might have seen this photo floating around, was of Bilbao, who he basically tilted his whole bar up to kind of keep the tops at a different angle, basically, and then put the hoods up and then folded them all the way in.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you looked at him from the front, and he looked like he was in aero bars, basically. Yeah. And obviously, that was the point. And yeah, it's something that we're seeing quite a lot, even in like regular road stages. I mean, the Trek guys in particular, I've seen a lot of photos of those guys' bikes, and their hoods are just folded all the way in, essentially, so they can stick their wrists on the bar and not break the UCI rule that says you can only contact the bar in basically one place and you can't put your forearms on it. It's sort of an intriguing way around that rule.
Yeah.
And the puppy paws rule that came into effect, two, 3 years ago?
I'm not one to advocate for more rules, but it kind of feels like, looking at how extreme some of these riders are taking it, it does feel like we're sort of due to have an angle limit on how far, say, from the line of the drop or from the line of the bend at the handlebar, how far in you can angle the hood. Because some of these setups are pretty extreme, and I believe professionals are capable of riding them safely, but it's something that a lot of amateurs are then emulating, and that potentially has safety ramifications.
Yeah, maybe like a minimum distance between the hoods.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah, something simple like that. That would also limit people using 30-centimeter wide handlebars. So, yeah. Rupe?
Yeah, I was going to ask, Dave, does it, if you push the envelope as to how far you move all these bits and parts, can it also impact the integrity of the handlebars and or the bike frame, or from a safety point of view?
It's probably not. I mean, from that sense, it's probably safe for the components. I think it's just where the danger comes in is through the handling of it, because you're basically putting your wrists under an extreme amount of unnatural curvature. So any like unexpected bumps or anything, and if the rider hasn't trained for it, then it's more likely that they'll, in my mind, it's more likely that they'll get bumped from the bike, bumped off the handlebars. And that's, I think, that's ever more present when you're talking about these positions that are, they're more likely to fatigue in and all that. So
don't try this at home.
Try it at home, but maybe don't take it to the extreme that we're seeing at TDU.
I think it's, in general, I think it's really great when the sport, it's kind of rare to have a situation like this where all of a sudden the mechanics have to come up with some new solutions, because, okay, we're suddenly riding a world tour race, but not on time trial bikes, but it is a time trial. And that presents this really interesting technical challenge. And in a week-long race, you can make a huge difference with just a few seconds in a prologue, particularly a week-long race in South Australia where there's not exactly Alpe d'Huez. So a few seconds in a prologue is going to make a big difference. And I think that's actually really cool. It's a little unconventional, but it's January, and, like, who cares? That sounds fun to me. That a few seconds in a prologue can really make the difference, and you as a mechanic can make that huge of a difference, which is, I mean, that's kind of what F1 is. It's mechanics making a big difference like that.
So do you guys think we're going to see the UCI in a couple of weeks, once there's other races without, when there's other races, we're going to see the UCI implementing rules on this that will be debated as the sock height?
As much as I just said that I love the fact that this creates this technical challenge and that's fun to talk about, on the other hand, in my 10 years of writing about bike racing, no story I've ever written has gotten close to as many reads as when the UCI banned the Super Tuck. So I would love for something like that, just so people can read stories. That sounds great to me.
Just to do my own corrections corner for the very same podcast, the UCI has, it turns out, UCI has implemented a minimum on bar width, so 350 mil from outside to outside. But it does seem that this, what the riders are doing now with their hoods, is sort of a tricky way around it. So I think, Kaylee, your suggestion of like hood to hood in inside measurement might be the next thing to come, because it seems like soon enough they'll just be pointing towards each other.
I believe it's still Mick Rogers is the UCI technical coordinator. So maybe he's floating around. Maybe he's floating around Adelaide, Rupe. You can go ask him. See what he's going
to
do.
Yeah, no, I was going to say it'd be great to get him on the podcast sometime too. Yeah. You know, we could have a whole gamut of questions, and I'm sure he'll have the answers for. But if I see him, I'll certainly ask him about all this.
He's done some really good stuff. It's a very hard job. Since I have just been doing this job in a little over a decade, I've seen at least five or six individuals attempt that particular role, and I would say Mick's doing an excellent, excellent job at it. Anyway, let's move on from the prologue. Dane, what happened in stage one?
Yeah, so stage one was a really fantastic stage. Just a ton of chaos, a really fantastic finale. I really hope that's what happens. I mean, the stage looks like it's going to be that way. If you look at the profile, you've got just a bunch of climbs of Mengler's Hill, which, I mean, I've never been on Mengler's Hill. I've never been to Australia. But looking at the metrics, looks like a fun little climb to go up. Rupert probably knows far more about it than I do because he is literally there. But at the end of the day, I'm thinking that somebody punchy will come away with a win. I'm hoping that's what happens because I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, Mengler's Hill is not a nice climb to go up, let alone race up, let alone more than once. So I think it ticks all the boxes there, Dane, with that. And there's a bit of wind blowing today as well. So I think we'll see that could have a bit of an impact as well in the latter part as the wind picks up and as riders in their first road stage of the year, some will be more fatigued than others, and some teams may be more savvy than others on how to use those wins. So we've thrown all the cards out there now. Let's see.
Predictions. Who wins? Who crosses the line first?
I love predictions that are going to be wrong.
Yeah, even before we. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I want to point out.
I'm throwing you under the bus.
I better bet y'all's margin, by the way, going into the stage. And again, by the time you listen to this, this could be different. But going into this stage, Alberto Bettiol, his margin for the Tour Down Under is pretty substantial. He already has an 8-second advantage in the GC. Mm-hmm. And again, at the Tour Down Under, maybe not at the Tour de France, but at the Tour Down Under, that's a pretty big deal, particularly a Tour Down Under with no Wollonga Hill. And I think this stage in particular is going to be a big one for him to try to hold on. And we'll see if he can do it with guys like, you know, I'm assuming Michael Matthews trying to push the pace on a punchy climb like that. Bettiol does have that skill set. So if he can hold on today's stage, he already has, I think, done a lot to get towards the win.
Matthews Jackson points on the first sprint, on the first preem. But I'm going to put my name out. I'm going to say not my name out there. I'm going to put someone. No, how about Caden Groves? You know, he was pretty close up there on the prologue, and he's got a good kick on him too. And I think, you know, his team are going to be certainly, up to try and, you know, put him in the best spot.
Yeah, that'd be a good ride. That'd be a great ride from him. Well, let's leave the men's race behind and drop into my conversation, wrapping up the women's Tour Down Under with Abby Mickey.
Oh my God, it's been so long since I've done that. That was so exciting. I feel like...
Welcome to the Placeholders Podcast, Abby Mickey. How are you?
I've never done a podcast before, so I'm a little concerned about my ability to talk to a large audience about things. But there's a first time for everything, and we'll see.
I have a huge amount of faith in your abilities, and so I think you'll be fine. Well, I mean, obviously, we're here to talk about your super top secret podcast is coming out on Friday.
Yeah. So it has absolutely nothing to do with cycling, except that it's three former cycling journalists. It's the only connection. But it is called The Album Files, and you can find it anywhere podcasts are found. And it is it's basically a book club, but for music. So one of us picks an album. We go away for 2 weeks. We listen. We think about how it makes us feel, and we come back and we chat about it. And then another one picks an album, and that is the podcast called The Album Files. And it is myself, Matt Deneef, and Ian Treloar. So as you can imagine, it gets real interesting.
You've already recorded the first episode?
We've recorded the first two. because, well, I would say Ian is really hard to pin down, but actually it was my fault that we didn't record for a month straight. So, whether this podcast lasts more than three episodes is up in the air, but we've got two recorded. Yeah.
Well, obviously everyone should go check that out. Three independent music journalists out there just making good podcast content. I am 100% here for it. The other thing that I wanted to talk to you about today, though, Women's Tour Down Under has just wrapped up. So we got a whole bunch of talking points. We want to talk about Amanda Spratt. We want to talk about Trek. We want to talk about all sorts of things. But I'm just going to kind of let you, I don't know, let you kick it off. What was the biggest, most important thing from the last 5-6 days that we need to talk about?
Yeah, I think the biggest, most important thing is the fact that World Tour racing has returned to Australia. I mean, we used to have a one-day World Tour race pre-COVID in Cadell's race, and it was one of the first races, or one of the last races, I guess, to happen before the world was impacted by COVID. And so the fact that we have kicked off the 2023 season with the Tour Down Under, the first year that it is World Tour, is really, really exciting. And it was a huge deal for Australian cycling. They've obviously kept the race going for a couple years, but on the domestic level, with World Tour teams weren't able to come in and go to that race. So the last winner of the race, but when it was more international, was Ruth Winder with Trek Segafredo. And for 2 years, it was like a locally type race. So it's really, really exciting that we got to see this race live for many, many hours down and World Tour. And we have another World Tour race coming up with Cadell. So we're starting the season really strong. And as you probably would have expected, the race was dominated by Australians, but it was interesting in that the main race was between Grace Brown and Amanda Spratt, who are not on Jayco Alula, which is the Australian World Tour team. So there was this really interesting dynamic going on where, you know, you have Amanda Spratt, who's fresh from that Mitchelton Scott beat Green Edge program and has moved to Trek Segafredo and is hands down, her and Brody Chapman, the newly crowned Australian national champ, are two of the biggest signings for Trek Segafredo going into this kind of next stage of the American team's life. They lost a lot of their top talent for the 2022 season, and now they're kind of starting over a little bit with a lot of their top tier talent. And so for Amanda Spratt to be up against a team that the only team she's ever raced for on a new team was like one of the interesting storylines throughout the race, but it was a lot. There was a lot of Australia. It was just a lot of Australia in your face. It was awesome.
What can we kind of learn about the landscape of the World Tour Peloton out of this race? I mean, granted, it's all the way down in Australia. They're sort of missing some key folks. But like you were just talking about how this is sort of maybe the end of a rebuild for Trek, for example. What else can we kind of take away from this particular week of racing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because one of the biggest disappointments I found with the race was that there was very limited number of World Tour teams. And there was a very limited number of top World Tour teams. I mean, they had basically FDJ and Trek were the top World Tour teams there. And then kind of like one step down, you've got EF Education, TIBCO, Silicon Valley Bank. And then one step below that, you've got the Jayco Alula team that used to be a much better team, but has kind of gone through a couple weird phases in the last couple years. They've lost basically all of their top riders. And I think that's one of the things that we saw in terms of the World Tour is FDJ is continuing to build on their success from 2021. They've, or 2022. What year is it? Who knows? they won the race overall with Grace Brown, and that should come as no surprise to anybody. I mean, they took control of the race on stage two when Amanda Spratt was off the front, and they set up Grace perfectly on stage three to have the easiest day possible to be able to chase down Amanda Spratt when she inevitably went on the corkscrew climb. They've signed Los Arhist, who is the esports cycling world champion, and that was a huge... They went out on a limb with her. She's been on teams in the past, but she basically tweeted her power numbers in an attempt to get a contract, and it didn't work. but they've picked her up for this year, and she was so valuable to Grace in this race. And I think that is really exciting for FDJ, because they lost their number one domestique in Brody Chapman to Trek. So for them to kind of be able to fill that role almost immediately, Loza won't be able to fill the captain kind of on the road mental thing that Brody would have been able to take on, because she's a newer rider. She's less experienced than Brody, but the legs are there, and that is really, really important. And she was able to like seamlessly jump into that domestique role with no pushback. So that was really big for FDJ. So to answer your question in a very long way, FDJ is continuing to build on their success. EF has really bolstered their roster. Georgia Williams was incredible in this race, and for her to walk away third overall is honestly really surprising. She's always been an incredible rider, but she's always been in a domestique, in a support role with Mitchelton Scott, Jayco, whatever the F team. And for her to go to EF, she made that move in order to get more freedom. And I think that this is, she's proved that she deserves it in getting third in this race overall. I guess I should also mention Human Powered Health won the first stage, their first world tour win, their first win in Europe. I mean, their team is like one of those like scratching your head, why are you world tour?
Australia is not in Europe.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Sorry. As far as I know. No, you're right. No, it's not. Geography. If it was, they would not have been racing in short sleeves. No, yeah, you're right. No, first World Tour win, and it wasn't in Europe. But that's a big confidence boost for a team that was really, really disappointing in 2022.
I want to talk a little bit of tactics here. So Amanda Spratt appeared to be the strongest bicycle rider in the bicycle race over the course of, every time it went uphill, she was solo, right? Was there anything that Trek could have done to win the bicycle race? Because she did not. She got second overall.
Yeah, I think Trek did what they could do. I mean, they had all of their riders on the front leading it out. I don't think that they could have been more aggressive to try to drop Grace. I think Grace has too strong of a team behind her at this point to try to play that card. I think it was just an unfortunate course for this type of rider that Spratty is. And she did everything she could have. Like she said, I think in a tweet or on her Instagram, the courses were just 1 kilometer too long for her. And it's really true. I mean, she got caught in the final 500 meters of stage two, in the final like 200 meters, 300 meters of stage three. And I think what could they have done differently? I think that they played the cards that they had, and it just did not work out in their favor.
It's just good to see Spratt back. She's just completely anonymous last year. I was just looking through her results earlier, and there's a lot of like 9th, 15th, you know, like there or thereabouts, but just nothing that you know, to write home about. So good to see her back at the pointy end.
Yeah, 100%.
What do we have coming up? What's the next big race in the calendar?
Cadell's. I mean, we got like a World Tour race in like a week. Or 10 days or something like that, which is just wild. But yeah, Cadell's Great Ocean Road Race is coming up next. it is an awesome race. They've always done a really good job of showcasing the women before it was cool. They have chocolate. They take you to a chocolate factory. I don't know. I as a rider, I just loved it. But yeah, that's coming up.
Wait, stop. We need to unpack that for a moment. When you get taken to a chocolate factory and you get to
eat chocolate.
Chocolate?
Oh, there's not just so the much winner, chocolate.
Everybody.
No, yeah, like everyone, like they have like a I think it was the first they have like the presentation, and it happens like on the coast, on the beach, and it's like very, very Australian. And then they have like this really nice dinner that they take you to, and there's just chocolate everywhere. And I seriously don't know the connection, but it's like there's so much chocolate.
Sounds all right.
Like I was like filling my pockets with chocolate, and it was so good. And I don't know
when does that kick off?
So that is the 28th of January. So that's in 11 days while we're recording, breaking the fourth wall. It's coming up.
Well, maybe we'll have you back on to talk about it. What do you think? Are you going to be too busy with your music podcast?
Yeah. Let me just check my calendar. I'm fully booked. it's going to be expensive for you to have me on the podcast. No, just kidding. I'm free. I'm fine. Please.
Well, thank you, Abby. Thank you for being our expert. Let's pull you back in. We're gonna go dive back into the men's race now with the rest of the crew.
Can I just say about the men's race that I'm just deeply disappointed not to see the defending champ Jimmy Whalen in the race. Just like the disappointment is like it just hurts my heart because he won last year.
And he had such a good ride at Nationals. And
yeah, he's so strong. Like that kid is so.
We were advocating for someone to pick him up.
Somebody needs to pick him up. He's like he's really really strong, and he's a good person. And I just love it when good things happen to good people. And he was incredible last year when he won the race. And I'm just really really disappointed not to see him back in the race, even for the national team. I don't know like how that shook out, but what are you guys doing?
Alas. All right.
That's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks, Abby.
Thanks for your time. The album files, check it out. Thank you.
Go check it out. Bye, Abby.
Bye.
Thanks as always for joining us, Abby and Rupert. We'll chat with you next week, right? I mean, you're not riding home, so you should be able to hop on the pod to recap TDU for us, right?
Yeah, really looking forward to it, and yeah, I'm looking forward to the plane trip home, and looking forward to catching up with you guys next week. There'll be a lot to talk about. I think I'm almost certain there will be.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks.
Good to see you, Rupert.
Thanks, Rupert. Good to see you.
Cool. Enjoy. Thanks, man.
See you guys. Enjoy. Have a great week, eh?
Enjoy the Barossa wines.
It is a few. Also, it's Peyo. It's Peyo, so Bilbao. Peyo.
Peyo?
Yeah.
Who said
I don't
pillow?
Know who said that.
Why did it? Why?
I don't know.
I
don't know.
That's a... Because, yeah, I mean, he's Spanish, so obviously there's a...
I'm sure it was a British
L's
person. Don't put this on the podcast, but they pronounce everything wrong, so... Quesadilla is, I mean, that's all you need to know.
I didn't want to name drop him just because I wasn't sure about the pronunciation. I just knew I'd get it wrong.
I mean, yeah, one of those things where I feel like I've heard it said the wrong way and was just repeating it. So I'm going to blame whoever I heard it from because clearly Peyo Bilbao is the correct name. Anyway, there's my corrections corner inside the same podcast. Dave Rum, you have a corrections corner.
Yeah, unfortunately. Turns out I didn't do my research well enough because last week I speculated regarding the 12-speed 105 mechanical shifting that looks to be inbound, and I pointed to the 1136 tooth cassette being wholly new and perhaps being shared across a new upcoming GRX group set. Turns out that cassette wasn't new. It's already available for sale. It came out with 105 Di2. It's just one of those products that when they released the 105 Di2, it was a We are selling it with an 1134 cassette. If you want an 1136, we will be making one in the future. And I completely forgot about it. So anyway, it's now available. Certain countries can buy that 12-speed cassette, but everything else remains unchanged. 12-speed, 105, mechanical appears to be on the horizon. And I still maintain what I said about GRX as well.
Well, our run of perfection had to end sometime, Dave.
Yeah.
So
did it ever start is the question.
No. No, it didn't. Okay. No, it didn't at all. Well, that corrections corner out of the way. My corrections corner out of the way. Mm. We do have some other tech stuff to talk about. We already talked about Pale Bibow's weird handlebars, which is the first thing I was going to talk about in the Geek Warning. We've covered that already. We've got a couple other things on this list, though. Scott Speedster recall. Mm. What does this mean?
The new Scott Speedster, so it was probably the first big road bike that the market saw. First big entry-level aluminium frame road bike, aluminum for those in America. It's a road bike, and there's also a gravel version of it. It's got integrated cabling, concealed cabling at the front end, and it's probably the first of its kind that we've seen where, they've really hidden the cables on an entry-level bike. Recalled. So, there's apparently issues with the carbon steerer tubes of those bikes that could result in failure.
We're saying we're cheering for this. We hate internal.
I probably shouldn't be so happy because it sucks for Scott to have to do a recall, and they do some great product. But that is a bike that I previously tested and was not a huge fan of. And I just feel like at that entry level price point, brands shouldn't necessarily be going for features like hidden cabling and overly advanced steerer tube setups. They should be focusing on offering great value for money and great functionality first and foremost, and with a focus on good ride quality. So that's one of those bikes that when I reviewed it for a previous publication, it didn't get praise. I think it's just one of those things that shouldn't be cheering for it, but at the same time, I'm kind of happy-ish to see that a bike that has been recalled is one that features the trend we don't want to see
At least they're not the bike of the one Australian World Tour team anymore. That would have been a really bad timing to have a recall.
Yeah.
You know?
That's also true. Yeah. Although they're not running speedsters anyway.
Yeah, they're running that same model. Brand. But yeah, same brand. So that sucks for anyone that has bought that bike. Take it back to you where you purchased it from to have that rectified. But also sucks for the shops involved that now have to reroute the brake hoses.
So it's not just an easy, fork swap. You got to do the whole thing. Is that karma? I don't know. No, because it's not the shop's fault. Mm. Anyway, next on my list here, SRAM has purchased an electric motor company.
It appears that way.
Now, I am no Nostradamus, but that would tell me that they're doing something e-bike related.
It's been rumored for a few years that they've been dabbling in the e-bike space in the background, and it's pretty safe to assume that they would, the way the market's been going, the way Shimano's dominating in that sense, the way e-bikes are going with integration, where the motor, at least for Shimano, their drivetrains are becoming increasingly more integrated with the motor, with things like automatic shifting and other cool elements like that. So, yeah, it makes sense that SRAM is heavily invested in this already, and it also makes sense that SRAM would increase their presence or their ability to be in the market with acquisitions, because we're talking about a company that has grown into other markets through only acquisitions. So they got into suspension with RockShox, they got into brakes with Avid, they got into power meters with Quark. So there's a theme here, and the motor brand is something I'm not all that familiar with, but it's Amprio. So it's German electric motor company, and it appears that SRAM has acquired them.
Watch this space. I like e-bikes, so I'm into it.
And more great competition in that segment is not a bad thing. Like between Bosch and Shimano, they've got a large portion of the market covered. So SRAM's one of probably the few companies that could really disrupt through the ability to, I guess, package deal their drivetrains as well.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that is the one thing I don't love about this. It's just another step down the line of like everything in your bike has to be from the same company or it doesn't work.
Yep.
Right. Which we've been in that space for a very long time, but it just gets worse and worse and worse every single year. So yeah, just another step down that pathway. Last thing in today's Geek Warning, we've got a bunch of confirmed new bikes floating around. Specifically, the UCI has just released its updated frame approval list. Now, the way this thing works these days is that they wait to do that essentially until a brand is kind of already launched. Now, we haven't seen a bunch of the bikes that are, or we haven't, I should say, we don't have like official information on a bunch of the bikes that are on this list now, but we have seen them and they're mostly Cannondales. So it's what, four new Cannondale models, right?
I don't know. You're looking at the list. I don't have it up.
I should say the avid reporter that unearthed this Runen McLovin.
Ooh, I
think
like that
was
name.
That was his name. Mm. Yeah, Irish fella. Anyway, he posted this on his Instagram, and bunch of new System Sixes coming this way. We've seen these floating around. They've already been ridden by EF, for example. So we kind of know what they look like. If you want to search around, you can already find those. But now they're fully confirmed. We have names and things like that.
Yeah.
I guess the point of me mentioning it is that if it's hit the UCI list, an official announcement is imminent. Like probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks, I would say.
Yeah. I would add that from something I saw on Instagram of some frames being painted, probably the standout feature of these bikes appears to be that they're running a almost triangular-shaped steerer tube, which suggests that Cannondale's revising the way they've traditionally done internal cable routing. The triangular-shaped steerer tube would basically allow... it basically gives space to the brake hoses to be run down each side of the steerer, which is quite different to how others are doing it. I don't hate it from what I've seen. Like it seems like it would in theory be an easier shape to manufacture than what some others are doing, and still in theory provide a good amount of strength. That's kind of interesting. I'd be keen to take a closer look at that when it's available. But I guess to confirm what you're saying, these days the brands can almost decide when they get made public with that UCI list. And on good authority, some brands play that to their hand, knowing that the media are looking at these lists. And it's a bit of a PR move. So yeah, as you say, the fact that those bikes are on the list isn't a leak. It's realistically to tease of something very close.
I wonder what's the equivalent for us. You know, we've got something coming. We've teased it. We sent a newsletter out. I should say Wade sent a newsletter out. What's the equivalent of the UCI list for us?
We're waiting on UCI approval, right? Yeah,
we're waiting on them because they'll totally give it to us. I'm sure.
Yeah. We just gotta put a sticker on your forehead, Dane, before you're allowed to.
I can dig that. It's like a rainbow sticker. I like that sticker. I mean, it's a cool looking sticker. I would wear that.
We could set up a bike company and submit it to the UCI for approval, so we then make it onto that list.
Ooh. Ooh. All right, that's your job between now and next week, Dave.
Sounds an effective use of my time.
All right, guys, I'm calling it. I'm calling it right there. We've talked about the things. We talked about the Cav. We talked about the TDU. Huge thanks to both Rupert and Abby for hopping on this episode. We'll get Rupert back next week to talk more TDU. And until then, thanks for listening. Share this. I keep mentioning this. Everybody you share it with is massively helpful to us. We're not at zero anymore, but we started at zero after these layoffs, and I shouldn't say shocked, but it's still a relatively frequent occurrence that people message me and are like, what happened over there? And they haven't seen what happened over there. Yeah. So share it. Share this. Tell them what happened. And we appreciate it.
Yep. And stop sending emails to our previous email addresses because we don't have access to them.
I don't have access to those. Thanks, Dane.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.